like Grandma and Grandpa used to play. Then I'll float on down the river to a Cajun hideaway.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O. News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We love some mountain music, don't we, Deb?
We sure do.
And we have with us a very special guest, Mr. Jensen Bissell, who's the park director of Baxter State Park. That makes you kind of a mountain man, right?
It's great to be here.
It's great.
It's I've been on top a few times.
It's great to have you. So let's get right into it, because there's a number of subjects I really want to cover. First of all, usually when we have a guest, we talk a little bit about their background, and you've played a big role in terms of your advocacy at Baxter State Park and nature in general. But why don't we talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you ended up as the park director at Baxter State Park, and then from there we'll talk about some issues and some things going on here in Maine and up at Baxter.
Well, thanks. I guess my pathway to the park is something that would help people understand that maybe you can plan for your career, but maybe that's a waste of time too, because there's some things you can't plan for. So I grew up in upstate New York. I was born in Schenectady, but I grew up in Ballston Spa, which is near Saratoga Springs. I went to forestry school at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry at the time. Got a bachelor's in resource management.
Do you remember what was, you know, I think for a lot of kids in college, sometimes it's something either by design or by an open course, but what was it that you think directed you back then to have an interest or a predisposed interest in forestry?
Yeah, I just liked to be outside. I had an interest in the biological world. I spent a lot of time and almost went to veterinary school at Cornell. I got accepted and I kind of weighed those two things. I spent a lot of time with a local veterinarian in town going on rounds, and I ended up going into forestry school. Don't regret that, and I really like the connection in forest management with a wider range of biology.
So talk about, how did you end up going from upstate New York and ended up coming here in Maine?
Well, I got out of forestry school at a time when jobs were tight in that field, and I ended up working as a logger. I was a self-employed logger for a year. Then I worked for the Saratoga State Tree Nursery and learned a great deal about tree culture and growth. And cone management and seed management and seed storage. And then I got a job offer from the Bureau of Land Management in Oregon. And we thought about that, my wife and I, for, I don't know, a couple of minutes. And at that point in my life, I could put everything I owned into a Pinto station wagon and a box trailer, and we drove across in the winter.
And Deb, you don't remember the Pinto, do you?
I certainly do.
So Deb, you know, Jensen, Deb, and I are in similar era. I'm sure Sully's in there going, Pinto, is that sounds like a small horse. Yeah, I remember the Ford Maverick and the Pinto. I think I had one of those.
Yeah. It was a great car. In fact, if you got struck from the rear, it could blow up. So
wasn't that
we didn't know that at the time. But
wasn't that the Ralph Nader? It was a Corvair, and then Pinto had their own problems. And
yeah,
all that.
Right. Anyway, we moved to Oregon. I worked there for about 10 years. My wife, Sheila, really wanted to get back closer to family. We had talked about always coming back after 5 years. I think if it wasn't for her, I would have stayed there. But I started looking for opportunities in the east, and this position with the park opened up. The park has 30,000 acres. Among its wilderness management, along with it, it also has 30,000 acres the governor set aside for forest management. And it was a unique opportunity to practice forest management in a way that would be very long-term. And I was attracted to the park's financial structure, which I felt was more sound and immune from other influences. And so, I mean, I remember I had a broken leg at the time. I'd been playing a lot of soccer, and I had my leg was in a cast due to an unfortunate incident. And I flew back here and interviewed. At that time, that was all on my own dime, and I had not many dimes.
So that was 1987?
Yeah, I actually got the job in 86, but we needed a month to square things away and get out here.
So as we talk about Baxter State Park, and by the way, we have Jensen Bissell here. He is the park director, Baxter State Park. Their website is baxterstateparkauthority.com. Why don't we start with defining what is Baxter State Park? Is, you know, in the name, it alludes to it's a state park. It is also, as we'll talk about later on, the terminus point for the Appalachian Trail. But who has control and authority of Baxter State Park? How is it set up? How are the finances set up? And we'll talk about some of the programs and some of the things going on up there.
Okay. Thanks for that lead-in, Steve-O. It's a great story. The park is a really fantastic story of what Governor Percival Baxter, or former Maine Governor Percival Baxter, put together from 1930 to 1962. There's a long story about why he ended up doing this, but he decided, after many times of trying to create a state park while he was a Senate president and then later governor, he decided eventually to do this himself. So he bought 28 different parcels over 30 years and gave each one to the state of Maine in trust. He bundled all those 28 trusts together into a larger trust. And basically, it's a very simple premise. I give you this thing in exchange for your promise that you'll always take care of it in the way I've asked. And he wrote trust deeds and communications that directed the park's management into the future.
So that history actually is important to you because you brought it up in interviews and there was an issue that happened in the last year that we'll get to. But the history and the foundation of Baxter State Park being a private donation as opposed to being either originating as a state park or under some sort of federal land management is an important part of the story.
Right? It's very important. And the governor, we describe it as he put together a very sturdy three-legged stool. There are three parts to this. I've looked at a lot of places, looked at a lot of models. I find two parts, but never all three. Along with the land that he bundled together and gave in trust, he also established a Baxter State Park Authority, a board of trustees that would serve in perpetuity to make sure the trust was managed in accordance with his wishes. Thirdly, he left an endowment fund so the trust could be managed independently from other state operations. So we are looked at as a quasi-state agency. The sole sovereign administrators for the park are the Baxter State Park Authority. It's a unique kind of three-legged thing, makes it very sturdy, very durable. And the only thing we do is try to manage the park in accordance with how the governor wanted it managed.
Yeah. So in some ways, even though it's referred to and it's defined as Baxter State Park, it's almost a private authority born from the trust set aside from former Governor Baxter back in 1931.
That's a great way to put it. I think, the governor called it Baxter State Park. In 1931, we didn't have a widespread state park system. So he was important. It was important to him to denote the park as a state of Maine park. He wanted this park to be saved for the people of the state of Maine. So that's confusing now in
sure.
in the common parlance because people think it's part of the state park system, but it's really quite separate in every way.
Interesting. We have Jensen Bissell here. He's the park director of Baxter State Park. So talk about, for people that may not be familiar with visiting Baxter State Park, talk a little bit about Baxter State Park in terms of its operations, in terms of the size, the scope, how many people go there every year, the infrastructure with both yourself as the park director and staff, and what kind of land management and services are available up there. And when people visit, what do they see at Baxter State Park?
Well, the first thing that's helpful for people to realize is the park is a big place. We talk about the size of the park at 210,000 acres, and that may mean different things to different people because we usually don't have to envision that. But on this landscape, all of South Portland and Westbrook and Yarmouth and North Yarmouth would be included within the park very easily. It's a large landscape. We have only about 60 miles of road in the park that help us access trailheads. The governor was very clear he didn't want roads to be the way that people recreated in the park, but only a means to get to the recreation in the park, to experience the park. So the roads are narrow, gravel. We maintain them that way because that's the way the governor wanted them. So you'll never see a paved road in Baxter Park, I don't think. We have a whole bunch of infrastructure for those roads. We have 10 campgrounds. Two of them are backcountry. You have to hike into them. The rest of them are roadside. The park is managed by around 60 people. In the summertime, classified employees, but about 40 of those are seasonal. So right now we're down to about 22 year-round employees. In the summertime, we have another 10 or 20 contracted folks that help us. The park has the highest mountain in Maine, obviously, with Katahdin, but it also has several of the other highest mountains in Maine and another 18 peaks over 3,000 feet and 225 miles of hiking trail. And that's a lot of hiking trail.
That's a lot. As kind of a quasi-private state park, is it under the jurisdiction of Maine wardens? And are they active at all relative to law enforcement? Or is it something separate?
The park's under the jurisdiction of the Baxter State Park Authority. We work really closely with the wardens, but the park has 5 commissioned law enforcement rangers. And so they have the same powers as a game warden, but we work very cooperatively back and forth, helping the wardens and the wardens helping us. The way it often works out in the summer months, wardens will work the park for violation of state fish and game rules, and the park rangers will write mostly summonses or enforcement for park rules and regulations. But there's a lot of crossover in that.
So talk about a little bit. Deb, have you been up to Baxter State Park?
I have never been there in my life, and I've lived in Maine all my life. That's bad.
You need to get up there.
I do.
You can bring me.
I want to come.
So when people visit, you know, you mentioned the size and the scope of approximately 210,000 acres, huge landscape. Is it primarily a hiking park? Primarily, you're maintaining the pristine nature, obviously, and kind of the interest of Governor Baxter, who donated the different parcels of land that ultimately became Baxter State Park. But is it part of the snowmobile trail? Is it part of our motor vehicles welcome? Or is it really set up for people to enjoy the most natural and preserved habitat of Maine at Baxter State Park?
Well, the answer really is yes to all of those, including the last one. The park does have limits on vehicle sizes because of the nature of the road. That's partly for safety to passengers on the road. We do not allow motorcycles on the park tote road, also for safety reasons primarily.
ATVs?
ATVs, no.
No.
But size limits for vehicles are generally allow a wide range of vehicles, but if they get too large, like motorhomes wouldn't fit in the park, buses won't fit in the park. There is snowmobiling in the park on the primary park tote road, which is 46 miles from end to end. We don't groom the park tote road. So what happens is we have a lot of early season use when the groomers can't get on the snowmobile trails in the woods. And then once the snow gets deep enough for the thousands of miles to be groomed around the park and our roads get rougher, the park is left more so to skiers and other winter users.
Yeah.
There's a lot of vehicle traffic in the park. We have about 65,000 visitors and 25,000 vehicles enter the park every year. But generally, we do maintain the park for the ability to people to get into a wild Maine landscape and experience that.
And how do the economics work in the park in terms of, is it by person, is it by permit, by vehicle? And you mentioned that when Governor Baxter donated the parcels and the land, he also set up an endowment. And so talk a little bit about, is it self-sustaining? Do you seek outside donations, or is it just self-sustaining and perpetuating based on the endowment and fees that you collect now?
It's an interesting question, somewhat complex. The park's endowment now is between $75 and $80 million. We gather about 55% to 60% of our annual operating budget from the endowment. For most endowment-driven or endowment-utilizing organizations, that's a high amount. So we're very careful with it to make sure that it's sustainable over a very long period of time.
It's a huge 75 to 80 million. I would love to have that endowment.
So would
I. And just talk briefly, because it seems like, obviously, with compound interest and appreciation of whatever the – what did the endowment start at, the Governor Baxter endowment start at?
$10 million, I'm sorry.
$10 million, yeah. And then it just kept growing?
We had a long history. When we look back at the endowment use, in the first, say, 20 years of the park's history, the endowment lost real value. And I don't think park management was terribly aware of that. On a nominal basis, the endowment was growing, but in terms of real value, through the inflation of the 80s, it did lose value. We became aware of that in the 90s. And the management of our endowment, and it's interesting to note that there's a couple of pieces of the park endowment, but the primary piece was left by the governor to his personal bank, the Boston Bank Safe and Deposit Company, which has since become Mellon and since become Bank of New York Mellon. But it's where he left the money. The corpus of the endowment is owned by the bank.
What?
Only the revenue produced by the endowment is available to the authority. So he was careful to make the money inaccessible other than to use for the park. But we're very careful about managing the endowment in such a way that our ability to use money is the same today as it will be in 50 years. No less, no more. Not trying to underspend today to credit future generations, nor overspend at their deficit. So it's a very tricky thing to do that kind of thing. We have a very talented investment committee that works on behalf of the park as a pro bono effort to help us interface with the fund managers, who I think are all in the same line, to make sure that our investments and the handling of the portfolio is done in such a way that we have a great deal of sustainability built into it.
What would the investment be that would be true to the spirit and the kind of the mandate of Governor Baxter? Is it to acquire adjacent parcels? Is it to provide infrastructure, education? And what does the endowment, what is kind of the mission of the endowment that you try to kind of balance every year, spending the right amount of money, not too much that eats into it, not too little that aggregates more? But what is the focus in the last couple of years? Maybe you can describe some of the investments and some of the growth that you've
done. Well, in general, we think it's better to own than to loan. So there's a primary focus on equities over the long term. We're not too much worried about short-term changes in the endowment value. We went through, and this was a big test for us, to go through 2008, 9, and then 11.
Right.
We lost a good percentage of the endowment value, but the park was able to function well. Our overall percentage of withdrawals as a portion of the endowment went up during that period. But because we have a steady flow of our expenditure requirements along with an active management of the endowment, we can live through changes in the endowment because we're not going to ask for more money in good times or less money in bad times. And we had that model built in the mid-90s, and we were really happy to see it survive its first really big test.
But is there, in terms of the scope, how many total acres?
210.
So is that number locked in and static, or you wouldn't be selling land? There would be no kind of logging rights or anything like that, or mineral rights or parcels. But is there any acquisition in terms of tangential properties that makes sense for kind of natural growth of the park?
Yeah, the authority has made, we've had three significant additions to lands of the park in the last 20 years. In 1993, we bought about 1,000 acres around Togue Pond, the southern entrance of the park, from the James River Corporation. That was a strategic purchase to help buffer the entrance to the park. It was a great move for the park to make. In 1997, the park picked up 2,600 acres from then Great Northern Company along the southern end of the park to extend the boundary from a more arbitrary boundary through the landscape down to the west branch of the Penobscot River. Again, from a management standpoint, strategically really helpful for the park, clarified our management, made it easier. One of the things the authority did at that point in time was, when they purchased that land, they failed to specify how they would manage it. And there's always two big questions when the authority would purchase land. Would there be hunting on that land? And would it be open to vehicles? And that became controversial. The authority ended up allowing hunting but not allowing vehicles, a compromise that seemed to upset almost everybody, so it must have been a good compromise. In 2005, the authority was gifted 4,000 acres at Katahdin Lake. In this case, they were preemptive in that very early they stated what their management ideals would be for that property, which would be no hunting and no vehicles. It was still a very controversial purchase, but it was easier for the authority to state what they were doing. And that was gifted through a very complex mechanism involving the Trust for Public Lands and the state of Maine. And it became a legislative controversy that was settled in the legislature on a question. But the park ended up with the parcel. We proposed an assimilation plan, and now it's a part of the park. But it would be important, I think, to the root of your question, Steve. We don't actively seek to enlarge the park. There are certain small strategic purchases that would make the park more easily and perhaps better managed. But what the governor gave us is what we really should have. And it's not our intent to dilute this by making it a much larger thing than the governor actually gave to the state of Maine from 1931 to 1962.
Got it. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Let's talk a little bit about the Appalachian Trail. Deb, you don't know my hiking background, do you?
No, I do not.
See, every show is a
learning experience.
It's a revelation.
Yes.
I grew up in Needham, Mass. Proud member of Troop 8, Boy Scout.
There you go.
Yeah. And I don't know why, but I came like, I don't know, 20 fire hydrants short of becoming almost an Eagle Scout.
No way.
Yeah. I went the whole tenderfoot,
nice.
Rank 2, first class, star, life. And then I was involved with sports, mm-hmm. and something happened.
Yeah.
It
may have been a girl. I think that derails a lot, but it also provides a lot.
Sure.
Yes, it does. I bet. Because Katie listens. She's like, what? Derails a lot? No, it provides a lot. It's perfect. But one of my most valued experiences as a young man, young adolescent, was my involvement in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts.
That's great.
And I don't know. We should have somebody on from Boy Scouts of Maine, because I'm not sure where they are as an organization relative to membership and participation. It feels like when I grew up back in the Eisenhower administration years and years ago, people were more active in Boy
yes.
Scouts. People were, you know, it was considered, if it wasn't cool, it wasn't uncool.
Right.
And I don't know if it has that same participation or involvement. But for me, it was one of the greatest things ever. And for 5 or 6 years, you know, being based outside of Boston, we would go to New Hampshire, we'd go to Maine, Vermont, 50-mile hikes. I've got, I think I have like 13 or 14 merit badges.
That's nice.
The whole tying the knot thing really messed me up. I don't know if I was dyslexic or if I was just, but there's something, especially I think for young people, as we've got more and more technology and more other things pulling at young people, I think it's so important to expose young people to the outside.
I agree.
So they have context on kind of the essence of life. If you're outside, if you're interacting with nature, interacting with the elements, interacting with animals that aren't human,
right.
you have a different, I think, perspective and hopefully more empathy and appreciation. But being a Boy Scout was something that was just really valuable to me. You know, when you're a 12-year-old kid and somebody says, we're gonna go 20 miles this way, and then with just this thing on your backpack, we're going to have shelter and we're going to make food, and we're going to be here for 4 days, and we're going to survive, and then we're going to come back. That's like magical. Like, really? We're going to do that and
yeah.
come back? So I'm a big fan, and, you know, many times in terms of hiking, you know, the Appalachian Trail is a couple thousand miles. I'm sure I've got the details on exactly, but it goes from Georgia, which is considered the starting point, right, Jensen? And the terminus point is at, is it? The peak of Catan within Baxter? So the terminus is, in my understanding, is that there's a certain number of miles that go within Baxter State Park, and nobody owns the Appalachian Trail. It's a series of segments that different authorities, different land authorities, different parks that it goes through. Sometimes it goes through asphalt, many times, but it goes through the Mass Turnpike. It, you know, kind of goes up the East Coast. But what portion of the Appalachian Trail is within Baxter State Park, and how did that ever come to be in terms of the history? And then let's talk a little bit about the Appalachian Trail and some of the recent history.
Well, the AT in Baxter State Park was established by Myron Avery. It was a fairly legendary feature in the AT history, and also in Maine. He was a Lubeck native and really advocated very strongly for the trail and did a lot of the earlier trail layout. Really strongly advocated among the trail, the AT community in the 30s, that the terminus or northern terminus, because a lot of people hike from north to south, so it becomes the starting point, not the terminus.
Yeah, by the way, how did that ever happen? Is it better to be the starting point or the edge, or is it irrelevant?
I just say it's a terminus. There are two terminuses, so it depends on which way you go.
There is no start or finish. You could go up or down, right?
And people do. People do everything you can imagine. But Myron established this, and there's a good story about this, in 1937, and tagged up an AT sign on Baxter Peak and called it good. Now, this was right about the time Governor Baxter had begun the purchase. In fact, he had purchased that land. There's no record that Myron Avery contacted Governor Baxter and said, you know, is it okay if we do this? I think that was the case for a lot of the early parts of the trail. It was an era where you could just kind of do these things and it was okay. Baxter never had any record in his trustees or communications about the AT, about his considerations of it. I think it's important to note that at that point in time, there might have been, you know, a dozen people a year that tried to do this. It was a very quiet, low-key thing. There was some in the text in the communications about a little bit of a kerfuffle between Baxter and the AT community when the AT began to post larger, more conspicuous signage in the park about the AT, and Baxter made them remove it. He wanted to be clear, this is, you know, my park. I'm making this park. It's not an AT thing. And life went on for a long time after that. But as we state, there's nothing in our trust deeds, no codicil about the AT.
So there's no easement, there's no either legal document or contract or an agreement other than just the informal history, which the AT, and as you said, years ago, long before kind of modern day communication and organized activities like this, there may have just been a handful of people that knew how to get from Springer Mountain, Georgia, up to Mount Katahdin and Baxter. And the other thing, I can't imagine in the early days that the trail maintenance was all that advanced, because with so few people traveling it, it had to be a little bit like an expedition adventure, whereas now, and I haven't hiked the whole thing. Deb, have you gone 2,100 miles on the Appalachian Trail?
No, I have not.
Sully, how about you? Have you anything, any experience with the Appalachian Trail?
Maybe 21 of the miles, but certainly not 2,100 of them.
So we can count you down for 1%.
There you go.
Yeah, okay. That sounds accurate.
That sounds right about yeah. accurate. But back then, it had to be just like a really kind of a bushwhacking kind of, you know, you had a compass and you maybe knew you were on the trail, maybe didn't, because even signage for 2,100 miles is a massive undertaking, especially when much of it would be in the north, cold weather where you have snow, ice, and seasonal stuff. So what's the history when the Appalachian Trail really started picking up steam as a thing, as a place where it was a destination? It was, you know, the notes that I have is that thousands of people every year hike some part of it. A fewer number obviously do the entire thing because it takes you know a couple of months. But when did it become not just popular, but as a specific entity, the Appalachian Trail, that people really pointed to as being kind of an achievement or an accomplishment?
Well, you'd probably have to ask AT folks about that for a better answer. And in our impression from the park, somewhere in the 70s, this started to get our attention with the number of hikers we were getting and the expectations hikers had when they got to the park. And we have very robust statistics in the park about the AT use, better than a lot of the AT, because the AT is so porous, it's very difficult for them to get accurate statistics. For instance, they will say roughly somewhere between 2,000 and maybe 3,000 people declare they're starting the trail in Springer Mountain to be northbound hikers. We know how many people actually get to us every year. And we look at it in four categories. There are northbounders, folks that hiked the whole trail from Springer Mountain to Katahdin in one year. There are flip-floppers, people that hike part of the trail and then worried that they wouldn't get to Katahdin in time, flip-flopped north and finished the Katahdin and then went back and finished the rest of the trail later in that year. Section hikers that do a piece of the AT every year. For instance, if Sully did this another 100 times, she could get the whole trail done.
Right.
And then there... Then there are southbounders, which is one of the most growing segments of the trail community. We have more and more people show up at the park in June wanting to climb Katahdin with a 60-pound pack and brand-new boots and then head south right into the 100-mile wilderness. And this is something that was rare in the past but now is fairly frequent.
And when you talk about the 100-mile wilderness, is that the section which is the least populous and the most deserted area?
Well, it has that name, that moniker that I've known it as the 100-mile wilderness for as long as I've been here, but it's the piece from Abel Bridge at the southern border of the park to Monson, about 100 miles. Takes most AT hikers from 5 to 7 days to cross it. Because of our management, forest management, logging, access history in the last 20 or 30 years, it's not that wild. There are many places to touch the trail within that 100 miles, many places to get to it with a vehicle. So it's not completely like people would. Like
we had our favorite word. Author in here a few months ago talking about his new book.
Oh, Paul Dwarin?
Yeah, talking about the 100-mile trail. So how many, I mean, you mentioned four categories of people. Flip-flopper sounds like the least desirable. If somebody labeled you as, hey, you're a flip-flopper, that doesn't sound great. But talk about roughly the numbers. So you mentioned you had the numbers, and obviously you don't have it written down, but approximately how many people in your records connect with the AT going in and out of Baxter?
We're just finishing tabulating this year because there are more AT hikers still coming up, which is another issue for us. But last year we had about 930 northbounders, a little over 100 south or flip-floppers. And we had something like 700 or 800 section hikers. People were coming to the park to finish that section of the trail. Now, I don't know if it's the first section, right, the last section, or somewhere in the middle, but that's a significant number. And then it was in the several hundreds now, getting higher all the time, of southbound folks.
Interesting. By the way, you were looking for his book, weren't you, Paul Dwarin's book?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He autographed it for me. Have you met him, by the way?
No, I have not.
Really interesting guy. We've also had folks from North Maine Woods in here, and we've talked about a lot of things going up north. We have Jensen Bissell here. He is the park director at Baxter State Park. We're talking about Baxter State Park. We're talking about hiking, Appalachian Trail, all that stuff.
It's really getting me excited to go up.
Well, the time's kind of running out, you know. It's getting cold
outside.
Well,
I might not make it this year, but I mean, I think next year. I have three grandsons. I think I'm going to make the trek with them. That would be fun.
You need to.
Well, what I tell people is it's always there. Mm. It will always be there. It does get steeper every year. I'm just telling you that.
I bet it does.
Well, yeah, we get slower. Maybe I get, I can speak for myself, heavier, and things get steeper. That feels like...
Well, you know, we can always walk around Katahdin, right?
You can.
Yeah.
225 miles of trail.
There you go.
There are great places to be without going on Katahdin.
There you go.
So, Jensen, now that we've brought up the Appalachian Trail, let's talk a little bit about an interesting story that became a national story this summer. And I have some notes here, and let me give you the quick overview, which you're obviously familiar with. But it appears that there was an extreme hiker, speed hiker, Scott Jurek, and he wanted to set the record for hiking the Appalachian Trail, starting down in Georgia and then ending up at the summit of Mount Katahdin. And the general gist, I've looked through a half a dozen stories, is that this guy, Scott Jurek, was competing for a record time. And that's what he covered, 47 miles a day, and he completed the 2,180 miles in 46 days, 8 hours, and 8 minutes. My guess is you didn't have much problem with him for the first 46 days in the first 4 hours, or, you know, but it was the last few hours and the last few minutes, which there it turned into a bit of a conflict. And I'll paraphrase what was written, and then I'd love to get your, you know, live thoughts on it. This wasn't a person who was just an individual hiker. This wasn't a person just naturally enjoying the beauty of Baxter State Park. It appears that it was an organized sport attempt. And I don't say that negatively. I just say it kind of factually. But he had sponsors. He had a headband. He had equipment. There was apparently a film crew that was documenting it. And there were some companies who were either sponsoring him or gave him products to use in his quest. And at 46 days, 8 hours, and 8 minutes, he gets to the top and he celebrates and something involving champagne. And from there, I think there's different perspective for this ultra marathoner. And you, as the both the spokesperson and as the leader, as the park director of Baxter State Park, kind of went on the offensive, and there were three citations issued to this gentleman in different categories. But it really brought to the forefront, I think, your position, which you've explained earlier, that Baxter is unique because it's operating under an authority. It's not legally connected, or there's no rights for the Appalachian Trail. And you felt that this person and the existence of corporate sponsorship somehow was at odds with the mandate and the mission of Baxter State Park, and you were pretty vocal. So Let's talk about that episode and then, you know, in kind of a broader sense on what that means for Baxter State Park going forward. Did I get most of the facts right? Because, you know, details matter, but...
No, you did a great job.
Well, yeah. I should also preface that in the spirit of full disclosure, we're a marketing company here. So immediately when somebody attacks corporate sponsorship, those are fighting words, Jensen. So I was like, oh, my God. Now, I understand from what I've read, and I think it's a really valid point you're bringing up. You know, we live in a time where everyone is trying to accomplish something and promote something and put something on social media and break a record. It's kind of the achievement era, and if it doesn't happen digitally, it's not real. My understanding is they had one permit, but they didn't have a permit to go within 500 feet of the summit, and the video crew breached that. But did you know that this group was coming, and were there other groups like it in the past? You know, talk a little bit about your position on this and your Facebook post that was very direct, saying that, you know, Baxter State Park shouldn't be commercialized and you are protecting the interest and the will of former Governor Baxter.
Well, thanks, Steve. I'll do my best. I like the fact that you characterized the Facebook post as very direct. That was the intent. It's been characterized in a lot of other ways, but when you press that send button, you have an idea what you're doing.
Sure.
In this particular case, it's very interesting in that as Scott Jurek came up the trail, I was a little aware that this was coming, but he wasn't really the focus. It was this media company that we've been working with to provide a permit to that I really didn't think was going to follow that permit.
So the Game Changers of Laguna Beach?
Yeah, you know, you have these folks coming from, in their case, California. You just have a sense when you talk to folks how this might go. So we had a ranger on top just to make sure that the restrictions of the permit were followed, and they weren't. But he ran into a number of other things as this kind of party erupted at the top, and he basically enforced park rules, and I think he did a great job in a difficult situation. But then it became more about Scott Jurek, which really wasn't what we were focused on. But it was an opportunity to make the statement. And this was coming to us more and more as the years went on, and more from the AT. So we laid it out. This is our concern, that these kinds of events that are driven by things that are really not in, don't fit well with the park's general use, that can have an impact on other visitors that are up there for things more fitting for how the park was. If you're up there with your family or your friends, and we had complaints that day that, you know, I picked the wrong day to go up Catawba and what a party it was up there. This is really not what the governor had in mind. It's not what the authority is trying to ensure on the peak. So we used a broader platform to talk about this in a wider range. And the background to this is that we've been talking with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy for many years about this, trying to bring these issues up. We felt they were strong, not only the use and the kind of use that was coming up the trail to us and culminating on Katahdin, because for them, it's the culmination of a big effort. So it's many of these things. For the rest of the trail, they're passing through. And right. The impact is a lot less. But for us, it's always the big party. And we brought that to their attention. We've been doing this for several years without any real traction. Could really not gain any real concern about this and get anybody talking about specific actions. So bringing it to that platform has been marvelous as far as actually getting good conversation going on what we're going to do.
Well, what's the status now? There were three citations issued. You made a very detailed post, I think, that was written on the park Facebook page that later on you said that you authored, and I've read that. He's claiming that you spread flat-out lies and disparaged him, you know, and his defense was he adhered to the leave-no-trace philosophy, which I think most people understand and most hikers and outdoorsmen respect. But this wasn't about leave no trace. This was more about what the activity is and what's permitted and what's not. Mm-hmm. But where do things stand now? Did he pay the citations? Is there still a conflict?
We dropped two of the citations, and he paid 2.5 times the normal rate for, I think, drinking in public, alcohol in public.
And that was just a sip of champagne, but the principle was, you know, enforce the rule as it is. One of the things that popped out in the story, by the way, we have Jensen Bissell, he's the park director, Baxter State Park, is you made a comment, and it's paraphrased here in a Portland Press Herald story, saying that you lamented the commercialization of the natural resource, and you suggested in some way that you may be forced to reconsider the relationship with the Appalachian Trail. And one of the options is maybe that isn't the best terminus point for the Appalachian Trail. If the Appalachian Trail is creating a condition at the park that you oversee that you feel isn't part of the mandate, then maybe the Appalachian Trail should end somewhere else. What was the effect? I mean, that seems like a pretty major position to take in something that for the Appalachian Trail that's been around for decades. And has that created positive discussion? Was there ever and is there now any consideration of really moving the end of the Appalachian Trail? Because you'd have to admit there's got to be some benefit for Baxter, if it's done the right way, to be the terminus point of one of the most iconic hiking trails in the world. And if you lost that, wouldn't there be a downside also?
What would be the downside?
I don't know. I'm not in the park director business, but I'm guessing if I want to have visibility, if I want to have the right type of activity and participation, that some people may visit Baxter State Park or some people may go to the summit specifically for the purpose of being at the place, which is either the end or the beginning of the Appalachian Trail. So if you take away that kind of overlaying element, it's still a beautiful park. It's still an iconic vista. It is still a magical place. But there's one less element that may have some impact. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, but let me try to explain it this way. The basic premise here is that we're a trust, and the authority takes their duty as trustees very seriously. And we haven't talked about this earlier, but the authority is composed of the Attorney General for the state of Maine, the Commissioner of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and the Director of the Maine Forest Service. The governor quipped he wanted the state's best forester, best biologist to run the park, and he needed the best attorney to keep them out of trouble.
Wow.
It's been a very effective group. This authority acts purely as trustees. They understand what the governor wanted in the park, and they're committed to keep that. So the governor was very clear in his trust wording that he felt that preservation of the park's resource and experience should be preeminent over provision of recreation. That's kind of upside down what we normally do. And so all of our actions are first and foremost to be sure we protect the resources of the park for current and future generations. Secondly, that we provide recreation. So when we get into this kind of trend where it's clearly affecting the visitation and the experience of other people, perhaps having an environmental impact, the authority is going to be very clear that nothing's too important for us to protect and do our duty as park trustees, including maintaining the AT within the park. So they're very clear that that's on the table, that we need to find a resolution to these issues. And what I keep talking about is that, you know, our numbers of AT hikers now are, you know, we have something like 2,000 AT hikers entering the park for one reason or another every year.
Going up, coming down.
It doesn't matter. They're coming in to climb Katahdin in one way or one fashion or another. And I can remember when that was, I can remember when we broke 1,000 and thought it was a big deal. And the trend line that we have from 1972 is a very clear upward growth pattern. And the model of the AT is oriented on continuing that growth. So as a manager, I would prefer to take care of problems before they get a huge issue, when you can sit down and rationally work things out. And we're really a little bit past that point here. So I asked the AT community, well, if it's 2,000 now, what happens when it's 4 or 6?
And what percentage of, if there's 2,000 hikers on an annual basis that are somehow connected to the AT, either as the terminus, the start, or doing a section, what is that in the overall number in terms of people who visit the park or visit?
We have about 65,000 folks, maybe 70. We had a big year this year, about 10% higher, that will come in the park every year.
So 3 or 4%. So it's a decent number, but it certainly isn't the driving force.
Not all the people that come in the park are oriented toward Katahdin. So we're focused on protecting some of the rarest habitats in Maine and some of the Maine's most iconic experience.
So are those discussions with the AT ongoing now in terms of coming up with kind of rules of engagement? When people start out in Georgia, they're handed something saying, here are the rules of the road. If you're lucky enough to get to Baxter & Katahdin, make sure that you have either the right permit or you respect the rules and the restrictions?
Of those are happening. The authority meets about four times a year. Twice a year they meet in Baxter Park at Kidney Pond Campground, and they had a meeting on October 4th. And for the first time in my history, I think ever, the executive director of the ATC and the superintendent of the National Park Service, Appalachian Trail National Scenic Corridor, came to that meeting. I'd never met these folks before this, so it was really nice to have that direct conversation between those officials and the AT and the Baxter Park Authority, so the authority could express their concerns here and that dialogue could happen. But the more important dialogue that's taking place probably right now is between my leadership staff and AT Maine and New England people on how to approach these problems in a more realistic way for the park. And I'm encouraged. It's better now than it's ever been.
Positive dialogue. We have Jensen Bissell here. He's park director, Baxter State Park. Their website is baxterstateparkauthority.com. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. It seems reasonable to me. First of all, I think it's a pretty cool accomplishment, you know, completely separate from the issue of following the rules or not, but doing the whole Appalachian Trail in, you know, 46 days, whatever he did it in, is pretty impressive. But we're a nation of rules and laws. And if the authority was set up by the person who donated the land, and he or she, in this case it was Governor Baxter, said, I want to keep this pristine. I don't want alcohol on top of the mountain. I don't want to have littering. Your position is you were really just enforcing the mandate and the authority that you had as the person leading the park, right?
Yeah, I think we're very cognizant that Katahdin, certainly Baxter Peak, has iconic significance to the people of the state of Maine, not just only the people of the state of Maine, but Native Americans, and many people have come to the park for years and years. It's very clearly stated what our directions of protection of that area were by the governor, and I think that the authority takes these things very seriously. I mean, we recognize the bond we have with the AT as long-term hikers and long-distance hikers. We love that in the park, and we have that common bond. And I think we can work through these issues, but there's some differences in the models that we have to try to somehow reconcile.
Just out of my own curiosity, what was the issue with filming within 500 feet of the peak?
We're trying to, and we have a lot of these requests now growing every year for folks to do media projects in the park. And we're trying to keep Baxter Peak from becoming a stage set more frequently than many people that have hiked to the peak, reached the peak, look at the peak as kind of the pinnacle of their wilderness experience, right, and look around and see somebody with a tripod and a camera. And a light screen and other rigging while they're trying to make this a set for someone to be filmed in a way that would be iconic for them, sometimes personally and sometimes profitably. So we're trying to mitigate those kinds of effects.
But there's some room for judgment. If NBC wanted to do a special report on Governor Baxter and filmed, you would look at the application and say, okay, as long as you do this, you can. It's not like nobody can go up to 500 feet. You just didn't approve this permit.
Right. Although more and more, I think that would be the standard for the way we would look at filming at the peak.
Okay.
There's another issue, Steve-O, that is concerning to us in general, and that this is Katahdin, it can be many other places in the country, are looked at as a kind of a common green.
Yeah.
And how do you effectively manage places where people will assume that since it's common ground, it's public ground, I can really do whatever I want, and I have the right to do what I want there. And it's becoming probably more of a challenge in this country than it has been 20 or 30 years ago.
I can tell you an anecdotal story that up until last year, I was chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council, and we have a very active bike and ped committee, and we have a trail system that we've set aside in Yarmouth. Much of it goes through power line corridors, and some of it goes through town property, and some of it goes adjacent to private property. And that issue is a huge issue, whether it's in a local municipality when people say, you know, if you allow a dog to be on a bike trail and that's in proximity to somebody's private home and private land, just the presence of a dog close creates, you know, kind of a rights issue. I think There's a lot of issues where people are both more aware and sometimes more sensitive to these issues, not just in public parks, but in, you know, in terms of private land use all across the country. So I think you're right. In the last couple of minutes, I got two other things I want to ask you about really quickly. One is, do you have a point of view on the Northwoods National Park issue, which is somewhat contentious, mm-hmm. and Roxanne Quimby and her son was in here last year talking about it. And I know it doesn't directly intersect Baxter State Park, but do you have a view on that and what that could mean for Maine, either pro or against that designation?
The sad answer to your question, Steve-O, is no, we don't have a position. We have 90 miles, almost 100 miles of park boundary, lots of different neighbors. We try to work cooperatively with all of them, no matter what their management standard is, and make good relationships there. So this is another neighbor that has another idea. There's obviously certain continuities with a park next door to us as far as our management and theirs, but we try to be good neighbors to everybody around us.
Great. Final question. Do you have a favorite beer?
I do have a favorite beer. Actually, several favorites, actually.
Several.
Yeah.
That is a setup question in that for those listeners that may not be aware, Jensen Bissell, two of his sons, are the owners and the namesake of Bissell Brother Beer. Hopefully, we'd love to get one of your sons in here talking about Bissell Brothers beer. But quickly, how did that come about that your sons, and you must be proud because apparently the company is doing really well in the last 2 years. They've really made a real impact here in Southern Maine. But how did that come about that all of a sudden, you know, your sons became beer gurus here in the Portland area?
Well, first of all, you are right. I am very proud, partly because of their business, but mostly because they're two good men. So it's been
great.
Fun to see that. But yeah, there's a great family story. Peter's told us a few times. Noah doesn't tell it as often. But Noah had started to work on homebrewing when he was at Farmington, and he got really interested in the idea of brewing beer, and he worked pretty hard at it. And we were all home, I think, for a holiday. It might have been Christmas, but it might have been a different time. And Noah brought this beer that he brewed, and he was very proud of it. He uncapped it and poured a glass for Peter, who took a swig and said, that tastes like I just wiped an ashtray across my lips.
Ooh.
And Noah was crushed.
Harsh.
And Noah will state that it was at that point he realized that this was harder than he thought, and he either quit this or bear down on it. And he concentrated much more on it. And he came back with another offering a little while later, and it was really good. And that began that idea. He still was a dedicated home brewer, but they took a trip across the country, and they began to think about, you know, maybe we can open a brewery. And starting at nothing without any real knowledge of how to do this and watching them go through it, they've done just truly a great job.
Well, maybe you could put in a good word for us to see if we can get one of those guys to come in sometime. We'd love to talk to them about their business and what they're doing here.
I'm sure they'd be happy to do that.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Jensen. This is I'm interested in the outdoors, and I think that Baxter State Park and Katahdin are both iconic and very, very important, vital elements in terms of kind of the broad landscape of Maine, and really appreciate learning more about that and learning about yourself, and hopefully we'll have you come back sometime.
Thanks very much, Steve. It was a great pleasure.
It's been great having you. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLLB, 1310 a.m. Go to BaxterStateParkAuthority.com. Learn more. Get out there, support Maine and our many natural wonders. We'll be back next week. Thank you.